The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
As the number of people hospitalised with COVID-19 rises, private hospitals have started to take urgent non-coronavirus patients after a surge capacity agreement was finalised over the weekend. HSE Chief Operations Officer Anne O'Connor is on the line. Anne, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, where are we at? Because I'm looking at the stats which were issued yesterday, and in the April peak, when we were in the thick of the pandemic, or so we thought, we had 881 in hospital, and as of yesterday, it was 1,452. We will be pretty soon double the number we had over April's peak.
That's right,
Pat. So it's a pretty bad situation.
It is, and this morning we're at 1,575. So that has gone up further from the number you just quoted there from yesterday. In the last 24 hours, we've seen an increase of 145 in our hospitals. The ICU number has gone up to 127. So you're absolutely right. We're heading towards the doubling of our peak in April of 880. And that's a very significant challenge for us across the whole health system.
Now, in addition, 600 beds are unusable because the staff is simply not there.
That's right. Yeah, one of the challenges I think that's very different about this compared to maybe a normal bad flu season is the impact on the wider staff group. So we know that as of yesterday, we had about 3,500 people not available for work across our acute hospital system only because of COVID. And they're people, Pat, who've either tested positive themselves for COVID or are identified as close contacts and can't work for that reason. So that has a very real implication. As you said there, we have between 500 and 600 beds now every day that are unavailable to us because we just can't staff them. And that's a big, a significant number when you look at the overall capacity within our hospital system.
Now, this is likely to continue. I mean, we saw the situation in Northern Ireland where they were begging people who were off shift to come back on and do extra hours. But, you know, the way things are going, the way the virus is rampant in the community and people who are working on the front line are not exempt from the infectivity of this virus. It's going to get worse unless we do something. And I'm wondering if you have any plan to do something that would change the direction of this for hospital staffs.
Well, I think there's a couple of things in that, Pat. So the first thing to say is that this, you know, anything that happens in our hospitals or anything that happens to hospital staff is as a direct consequence of the high level of community transmission. So our staff live in communities and where there are high rates of transmission, they aren't immune to that. So we see the bigger areas where we've had bigger outbreaks in local communities, we have a greater challenge in terms of staff being unavailable. So there are two things. I mean, you mentioned there about staff being asked to come back in when they weren't working in the north, etc. We did that ourselves yesterday in Letterkenny. We were very challenged on site and we had to put out a call to staff who weren't rostered to work yesterday to come back in yesterday evening. So that is starting to happen here. I think the most important thing to say is that this is something that everybody has some power over in terms of their actions now to reduce the spread of this virus, to reduce the level of community transmission so that it doesn't impact as much on our healthcare staff. Going back to your question in terms of what can we do, we are obviously looking at the use of all available staff. And we will continue to do that. And there are some sites that are more heavily impacted than others. It's interesting in this surge, previously it was very much the East Coast that was hammered in the first wave. Now it's actually not. It's all over the country. So it's a slightly different challenge for us. But we are looking at how we can work with staff and I suppose maximise the staff available. I think it's important to reference, though, that this challenge isn't just in our hospitals. Our community services equally are very challenged by the high rate of transmission. And it's our community services that support nursing homes, for example, when they have outbreaks and they're in trouble. And we know that last week there were nearly 1,000 staff missing from nursing homes. So significant numbers all round.
Yeah. Now, much was made of the fact that routine testing had been installed in nursing homes. But when I asked, I was told, yeah, they're tested once a fortnight, which is utterly useless. Useless. Absolutely useless. And how people kind of boast about testing in nursing homes with such an inadequate testing regime. Sure, it's a recipe for infection.
So I would disagree that it's useless. I think that the introduction of
every fortnight, come on, every fortnight tells you nothing. You know, how long has that person who turns up positive, how long have they been spreading the virus? To which patients, to which guests in the nursing home have they been in close contact with? What happens then? Once a fortnight is simply inadequate. And you could have, and it's been recommended for use in precisely these situations by the EU, mandated before Christmas particularly, lateral flow testing, antigen testing should be used virtually on a daily basis. And you can keep people working who are not infectious, and you can get people sent home as soon as they are infectious. But for some reason, the HSE, the politicians have turned their backs on this very useful tool.
Again, just to reiterate, I don't think that fortnightly testing is useless. We are looking at the introduction of weekly testing. Our testing regime comes under the remit, I suppose, we're guided by NPHET in terms of how we do that. And we are looking at weekly testing. I think it has proven to be very effective in terms of identifying outbreaks much earlier. We've seen that our public health colleagues and certainly our outbreak control teams have been able to step in at a much earlier stage by virtue of having serial testing. But as I said, we are looking at weekly testing as well. The discussion in relation to antigen testing, that's been, I suppose, that is still in train with other people. I have to say I'm not the expert on the different types of testing myself, but certainly we are looking at increasing to weekly testing.
I sometimes despair of this because there are lessons to be learned from other jurisdictions which we resolutely refuse to learn. We were late on masks, we were late on so many things, and we'll be late on antigen testing too, which is, as I say, a useful tool because you can keep people in work who are not infectious and you can send people home before they enter the wards. But, you know, if this testing of nursing home staff is so great, how do you explain 1,000 of them can't work?
So I think that we, again, Pat, just to reiterate.
You judge by your success. No, seriously. You know, if it is a successful initiative, then you should not have 1,000 people out of work.
Yeah, and I think that's something that has been looked at, certainly in terms of NPHET, in terms of occupational health leads. So looking at the use of weekly serial testing in nursing homes is something that is underway. There's also discussion underway in relation to antigen testing. But as I said, I'm not the expert on antigen testing. So I think in terms of my role really is managing the rollout of the different initiatives across our health services, looking at the capacity across our health services, and looking critically at how we can maintain services that are not just related to COVID. So we have a lot of people out there who need health services other than for COVID, and we have to look at how we can prioritise their care as well.
Yeah. Now, I know a deal was done over the weekend with the private hospitals. Where are we at in terms of where that is going? I mean, if someone is due an appointment in a hospital which has a lot of COVID cases and they're now going to be diverted to a private hospital, how will that mechanism work?
So there are different things. So, for example, we know that in some cases, hospitals, so the public hospitals have been given access to booking systems. Just for listeners out there, this deal relates to being able to access 30% or up to 30% of the capacity. So at a lower level of I suppose cases nationally, it would be 15% and then increasing to 30% in terms of the hospital's capacity. And that is either us being able to refer people to the private hospital, so actually sending patients to the hospital, or equally us being able to access their facilities. So, for example, where we have kind of very specialised work, it may be the case that a specialist team will move between the public hospital and the private hospital from effectively a COVID environment to a non-COVID environment. And in reality, you know, that will be managed through the teams. So where a team, and we see examples already, Pat, in terms of some services around the country, for example, in the south, where the Bon Secure have worked very, very closely with Kerry General Hospital, and other examples where we're accessing specialist services already. So that'll be managed through the services in terms of the specialist team or the booking systems.
But would the specialist team just move to the private facility and remain there? I mean, you wouldn't want people going back and forth between the facilities because the risk of infection then would be higher.
Well, I think certainly the teams, you know, our staff are highly skilled in terms of moving between these locations already. And they are very adept at this stage. We're 9 months in now in terms of the use of full PPE, etc. So that may be the case that is happening currently in some instances. But as I said, in the majority of cases, it'll be people being referred to the private hospital where they will be cared for by those teams.
I was interested in what you said about, you know, where the virus is rampant in the community. Well, that's going to be reflected in the hospitals. And I heard your boss talking about using exactly the same words, that if the levels are high in the community, then they're going to be high among hospital staffs and other frontline workers. But you'd expect people in the front line to be better able to take care of themselves and protect themselves, even when they do mix it in the community, would you not?
I think we are all at this stage very conscious of what we need to do in terms of protecting ourselves. However, clearly we can see from the case numbers nationally, that's not happening. So I think that there's now we have early indications that the, you know, there are positive signs in terms of the positivity rate on that. But I think it's very important that we're not getting into any situation of blaming anybody here. So we can see that the case numbers have gone very high. We know that from a health service perspective, they haven't peaked yet. We think that, you know, it'll be over the end of the coming week, potentially. And that is when you look at the time lag between people being infected. But I suppose, to be fair to everybody, none of us know where this virus is. And I know our chief clinical officer, Dr. Colm Henry, would always say we're the worst, you know, the worst assessors ourselves in terms of whether we potentially have the virus. So it happens to people. And all we can say is that people need to reduce their mixing. Unfortunately, for essential workers, it's not an option to stay at home. So we need our staff, and, you know, not just in the health service, but there are many other essential services where people have to go to work. So the less, I suppose, if we can reduce mixing in general, we reduce the rate of transmission. And I think, to be fair to everybody, you know, we have people who have to go to shops, who have to go to all sorts of places just to be able to live and work where they're required. So I think that certainly our staff are very, very aware of the, I suppose, how to prevent transmission. What we know is that when people are actually at work, people are very, very clued in because of the, I suppose, the rule set related to working in healthcare environments in the terms of the use of PPE, hand washing, etc. But when people are tired and their guards are down, you know, they can mix more easily and they mightn't be as aware.
Now, in terms of the vaccine rollout, where are we in terms of the people who mix with patients, the frontline workers getting the vaccine? How soon do you expect all frontline workers to be vaccinated?
Last week, in the past 7 days, we have rolled out over 35,000 vaccines, actually closer to 40,000. The majority of those are frontline healthcare workers. So last week, there were about 3,000 that were in some nursing homes, a small number of nursing homes, 23. This week, the focus is on nursing homes. And we, between Monday and Friday of this week, will be administering about 20,000 vaccines across 156 nursing homes. And then from Saturday, this coming Saturday to the following Sunday, a further 58,000, so across approximately 400 nursing homes. So by Sunday week, we hope to have nearly all nursing homes, as well as some disability units and psychiatry and later life units. And from a healthcare worker perspective, we'll have fewer healthcare workers this week because we're focusing on nursing homes. We're very much restricted by the supply. So at the moment, we are still looking at about 40,000 a week. We will scale that up as supply comes available. Unfortunately, we don't have visibility of that. So we have plans in place in terms of rolling this out. And certainly what we've seen since the beginning of this rollout has been an overwhelming positivity. So as soon as we have vaccine, we are in a position to roll it out.
And now, one of the issues in New York particularly, you may have read about this, is that there is a resistance in frontline staff actually taking the vaccine, this vaccine hesitancy they talk about. Now, the seeds were sown, obviously, in the United States by anti-vaxxers and so on. But when we look at the prevalence of medical staff who don't bother to get the flu vaccine every year, how confident can we be that people on the front line will be vaccinated against the coronavirus?
Well, we're very confident. I think, you know, when we were planning this, we had a concern ourselves in terms of possible hesitancy. And as you said, in terms of the flu vaccine, we see a reluctance in some parts, although that has increased in recent years. What we have seen actually since the beginning of the this kind of rollout has been an overwhelming positivity, to the extent where we're extremely surprised. So we know that our National Immunisation Office would normally operate on the basis of an 80% uptake at a max. We've had to increase that. We have seen an overwhelming desire by frontline workers to get this vaccine. So we actually
And would you take people who do not get the vaccination? Would you take them off the front line?
That's something that I suppose we haven't had to consider really yet. We've looked at that previously.
No, but 80% still leaves a 80% would still leave a 20% deficit. If that were the final figure, you wouldn't want people who refuse to be vaccinated on to be on the front line, would you?
Ideally not, but we have no evidence yet that frontline workers do not want this vaccine. It's quite the opposite. So our challenge at the minute is actually that everybody wants it. And it's great, both in terms of receiving it and also administering it. We have everybody putting their hands up to be vaccinators. So I think that's been really positive. So
which
we
is
have
good.
No evidence.
That is good news.
Yeah.
A Kilcullen listener, though, says, can you please ask the HSE Chief Operations Officer, why are admin staff getting so many of the COVID vaccines in preference to those frontline nurses?
So we're not the admin staff. The only admin staff that will have had that vaccine yet will be in our acute hospitals. What we are doing, and certainly we have Professor Martin Cormacan working with us in terms of identifying the most vulnerable groups in terms of patient-facing groups. Important to say that, for example, receptionists working in hospitals in our emergency departments, they are frontline workers. They are admin staff.
Absolutely.
But
oh, no,
they are
absolutely.
Also
I would not
workers.
Quarrel with
yeah.
that at all.
Yeah.
I suppose
yeah.
people in the back office is possibly what that Kilcullen listener is referring to. People who, you know, who don't interface at all. But maybe in the canteens, they interface with the frontline workers.
Absolutely. And I suppose in many hospitals, they're working on the basis that particularly in sites where people are moving around, that they need to immunise. And, you know, it depends on the size of the hospital too. Some hospitals don't have huge admin numbers. Some of the bigger entities do. But certainly from our perspective, we've been very clear that the priority is patient-facing workers, regardless of their discipline or grade. Mm. And we are also looking at, for example, porters, cleaners, anybody who's moving around the hospital site.
This one, I work in a nursing home. Testing is not compulsory. Many staff don't bother with it. Please ask why.
It's not compulsory for anybody, and it never was mandatory. I think in terms of nursing homes, we have an additional challenge.
Hang on a second. Why is testing? This is not like invading someone's body with a vaccine where they say, I don't know what the RNA might do to me 20 years from now, et cetera, et cetera. You know, people have harum scarum ideas about what vaccines might do. But testing is a brief moment of a swab in your gob. Why would it not be compulsory? If you're going to work in a front line where there are vulnerable patients in nursing homes, elderly patients, often with underlying conditions, why would it be acceptable that someone would refuse a test?
I personally don't think it's acceptable. I think just to be clear, in terms of nursing homes, the majority of nursing homes in Ireland are private entities. So 80% of the nursing home provision is private, 20% is public. And it is a matter for the employers to work with their staff, but we do not have mandatory testing, just like we don't have mandatory vaccination in this country.
And the two are very different. Now, the two are very different. As I say, you're getting a chemical in your body is one thing, and people for all sorts of reasons, allergies and so on, may have a genuine reason for saying, no, I can't take that. I wouldn't risk that because of the risk of anaphylaxis or whatever it might be. But in terms of a test, there's no reason.
Yeah. And I know we have seen, for example, when we have the testing of close contacts that people, you know, would return up for the first test, not the second test, back when we were doing two tests. But it isn't mandatory. And I think that's, you know, that is the way it is. We don't have any legal basis for making it mandatory. The only legal basis for anything in relation to infectious diseases relates to public health. But testing is not mandatory, either in the public system or the private system. We have seen a very good uptake of testing in general, but we know that in some nursing homes, and particularly as time has gone on, people have been less keen. But we equally have nursing homes that are pretty much 100%. So that is something that we continue to try and encourage people to take up testing, and certainly we work with Nursing Homes Ireland to promote that as well.
What is it about in this jurisdiction that it's all wishy-washy? We'll encourage, we'll ask, we'll have guidelines, not rules. What is it? Like, if you want to work in a nursing home, you have a job, you want to keep that job, well, you obey the rules, even if they're temporary rules, you obey the rules. What's wrong with that?
Again, that's a matter for the employers, I guess, and the HSE. It isn't mandatory either, Pat. So I think in terms of the remit...
It's not mandatory. Did I hear right? That you cannot ask someone in the HSE, say, you take a test or you're not going on the ward. That you can't say that in the HSE?
It's not mandatory. But
that we're paying for?
In terms of frontline workers, Pat, we haven't had a problem in our frontline services. People have been tested. People are being vaccinated. The challenge you mentioned there related to nursing homes, and that is a slightly different discussion. So they are not
public sector workers. No, I just want to read this loud and clear for our listeners. You work in the HSE. You are paid for by the tax person, all of us. And you can say, no, I'm not going to bother with the test. I'm going in on the ward. I mean, that is unconscionable. whatever about your argument about private nursing homes run by private operators, and I believe they should be compelled as well, but in the HSE, run by the state, that someone can say, I'm not taking a test and I'm going in on the ward. I mean, that's crazy stuff.
That's the, currently the position, Pat?
All right. Now, the other big ethical issue that might be looming, and we hope it won't, because we hope that we'll somehow flatten this desperate curve. Luke O'Neill, who'll be on with us later, he was on the news last night saying we flattened it in the wrong direction. It's going straight up instead of straight across. We're hoping that the numbers will not get so bad that ethical decisions have to be made about who's to be treated and who's to be left to die. But you have a framework.
There is a framework for that. So certainly there's a framework that was developed in the first wave. So with medical ethicists and others who are very expert at this in terms of identifying. I think it's important to say that our intensive care clinicians are highly, I suppose, expert at this in terms of deciding how care is provided to people. Thankfully, we haven't found ourselves in this position yet. There's a framework there that we haven't had to use, but certainly they work with people. And Dr. Cillian O'Kelly, actually, who was at our press briefing last Thursday, gave a very good flavour of how the teams work when they have people who are extremely ill. So in terms of decisions being made, that these decisions are made well in advance with somebody and their family in terms of the intervention and care that might be provided. So no clinician wants to be faced in, I suppose, a crisis situation having to make these decisions. So that is something that the consultants have thought through with patients and their families when they are sick, as they become sicker, so that it's not a last minute decision.
Yeah, but the moment when you've got someone in an ambulance and you decide, no, I'm going to send them back home because such is their medical condition that I've got a choice of giving a bed to someone who has a good chance of surviving versus someone who's quite sick. When is that likely to happen?
I think in terms of sending people home with ambulances, we're not really there. So there's a couple of things on that. Just one is that we obviously try and provide care to people to reduce the need for people to come into hospital. So really for us, it's about managing the capacity with the number of people who need health services overall. So the sickest people need the hospitals more so than anybody else. The reality for us is that we still have capacity in our system. So as of this morning, we still have over 500 beds available and we still have ICU beds available. So we've 38 adult beds available. And that is managed on an hourly basis in terms of where we need to move people around. But equally, we have some excellent facilities in the community. We have a very committed GP population out there to support people to come home, even when they're still sick, but they just don't need that very high level of intervention.
Okay. Right. Well, look, thank you very much for your time. Anne O'Connor is HSE Chief Operations Officer. So many points coming in, but we don't have time to deal with them all. But Anne O'Connor, thank you very much for joining us.